trail mix.
Critical Camp
from Kessel Barton
on the Lizard
in Cornwall,
the summer of 2016.
So, yes, welcome to Critical Camp number 4, here at Kessel Barton on the Lizard Peninsula. So, as you've probably read or you know if you've been here before, the Critical Camp's a kind of extension of a project called the Lizard Exit Plan, which I've been working on here for 3 years now, on and off, which is to look at how the whole Lizard Peninsula could become self-sufficient in the event of some kind of hypothetical apocalypse.
Ecological thinking increasingly denounces the expansion of human agriculture,
its industrial scale,
its effects on our fellow creatures.
Many cultures have found it possible to live off the land
in a way that leaves space for the non-human.
But is this a possibility today, considering the exponential growth of human populations?
How do our methods of food production reflect our relationship to the rest of the animal?
And how does the recently emerged field of dark ecology
help us negotiate the population problematic?
Investigating food production, rewilding, and the relationship between agriculture and ecology in practices from foraging to hunting and trapping, this Critical Camp takes an empathetic but unsentimental look at the relation between the human and its prey.
Okay, so that's the basic idea. Okay. It'd be alright, it's just because we're trying to make the recording. To start with, I'm going to talk to you about some work that I made over a 10-year period on a site near Falmouth, which was called Field Club, It was basically a 4-acre site where I tried to put myself into this restricted area and see if I could grow all of the food that I would need to survive. So it was an attempt to become self-sufficient using low-impact agriculture. And the attempt failed, really, in many ways. But what it did give me was a unique opportunity to kind of try and envision myself as another species existing within a wider food web, with all the other species which were using this small piece of land around me. So I was putting myself within this system of biological niches and my relation to the non-human. So all of the other species which aren't people. So the first thing that I learned was that nature holds no special regard for the human. And this is kind of exemplified by this here, which is a little addition that I made, which you can pass around. This is a cast of an ear of corn from a whole series basically I tried to grow a small field of maize, and the weather was pretty bad at the time, and it just rained continually through the whole flowering period, so none of the corns were pollinated properly, and therefore when they developed and peeled back the green outer husk, what you had inside was that, which is like pitiful in terms of an attempt to be self-sufficient. So this is like the first lesson, really. It's like no matter what you do within this system and trying to become self-sufficient, nature's always going to work against you in some way, or there's contingencies at play which you can't control.
Community and
Britain, best of islands, lieth in the western ocean betwixt Gaul and Ireland, and containeth 800 miles in length and 200 in breadth. Whatsoever is fitting for the use of mortal men, the island doth afford in unfailing plenty, for she aboundeth in metals of every kind. Fields hath she, stretching far and wide, and hillsides meet for tillage of the best, whereon, by reason of the fruitfulness of the soil, the diverse crops in their seasons do yield their harvests. Forests also hath she filled with every manner of wild deer, in the glades whereof groweth grass, that the cattle may find therein meet change of pasture, and follow of many colours, that do proffer their honey unto the bees that flit ever busily about them. Meadows hath she set in pleasant places, green at the foot of misty mountains, wherein be sparkling well-springs clear and bright, flowing forth with a gentle whispering ripple in shining streams that sing sweet lullaby unto them that lie upon their banks. Watered is she, moreover, by lakes and rivers, wherein is much fish, and besides the narrow sea of the southern coast, whereby men make voyage unto Gaul by three noble rivers, Thames to wit, Severn and Humber, the which she stretcheth forth, as it were three arms, whereby she taketh in the traffic from oversea brought hither from every land in her fleets. Extract from the Histories of the Kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth, who died circa 1152. Translated by Dr. Sebastian Evans.
And this is kind of like the whole project became a kind of opportunity to understand this concept of dark ecology, and a concept called enmeshment, which I'll talk about in a little bit. So the grassland at Field Club was managed in a low impact way. So the grass grew up really tall, and then in the autumn it falls over and thatches back into itself. It makes these perfect conditions for a little animal called the field vole. It seems really great. Until I decided that I wanted to use this area of ground which had become rank grassland to grow some tree crops for biofuel and for building materials. So this is my, in an attempt to become deep green, to go zero carbon. Every time I planted these tree crops, the field voles would come along and ring bark the trees underneath the grass, right? It just became completely impossible. I realised that I was really, again, up against nature in this complicated system, in this ecosystem I was sort of immersing myself in. And the field voles were sort of exhibiting what we might call a phenotypic desire to control the environment for themselves. Like, they wanted it to stay as grassland, so they weren't actually allowing me to grow trees, because that would deny them their habitat, right? So I decided the only way to deal with this was to change the ecosystem, to start cutting the grass, to stop it being rank grassland. And then this is the result. Like with the mower, every time you kind of like go along and try and cut this grass, you're just chopping through all these field voles. And this is a complete irony, because, you know, the field voles were only there because I'd allowed them the room to be there. My management system was far more low impact than the neighbouring farmland. So they were flooding in to my site because I'd given them a niche, or I was allowing them a niche, this kind of idea of Lebensraum, you know, it's like living room for other things. And then when you go through this this system, you end up having this irony where you're giving something room, and when you want to act within that environment for your own benefit, then inevitably you kill something, which doesn't happen in normal farmland because there isn't room for them there in the first place. So what do? So I made a little graveyard and I started to bury them. So this is the graveyard at the moment. It's been there for years now, and I maintain it like this. Keep it, everything clipped away from it, because, you know, we can't have nature impeding on the sentimentality of the human toward nature.
There are thoughts we can anticipate, glimpsed in the distance along existing thought pathways. This is a future that is simply the present, stretched out further. There is not yet thought that never arrives, yet here we are, thinking it, in the paradoxical flicker of this very sentence. If we want thought different from the present, if we want to change the present, then thought must be aware of this kind of future. It is not a future into which we can progress. This future is unthinkable, yet here we are, thinking it, coexisting. We are thinking future coexistence, predicting it and more, keeping the unpredictable one open. Yet such a future, the open future, has become taboo, because it is real, yet beyond concept, because it is weird. Art is thought from the future, thought we cannot explicitly think at present, thought we may not think or speak at all. If we want thought different from the present, then thought must veer toward art. To be a thing at all, a rock, a lizard, a human, is to be in a twist. How thought longs to twist and turn like the serpent poetry. Extract from Dark Ecology by Timothy Morton.
Vacant, and I forgot the taste. essence. Future is so different today.
First quote of the day from this book here, which is The Balance of Nature by George Addy. And I'll just read the front page here. The Balance of Nature and Modern Conditions of Cultivation, a practical manual of animal foes and friends for the country gentleman, the farmer, the forester, the gardener, and the sportsman, by George Addy. So this is published in 1909. And it's a very interesting little book, because basically he puts forward in the first section, he shows the whole history of the movement toward the creation of the national parks, and he talks about the problem of the lover of nature agitation and all of these different protective acts which sort of emerged in England from the 1300s onwards. So it's kind of a document really showing how how our attitude towards nature and its protection has kind of emerged. But I just want you to hear this little bit here about field voles. The field vole, Agricola agrestris. This small animal, about 5 inches in length, is of a reddish-brown colour above and grey below, and found in woodland glades, grassy plantations and meadows, especially in hilly and moorland districts, on bog, strong marshy land, either grazed or mown for hay. Parks, mown or ungrazed orchards, rough grassy parts of pleasure grounds, always where there exists a considerable depth of bottom grass or debris of gramineous vegetation. In this soft bottom, the field vole makes runs, never burrowing deeply, and cuts the grass between the root and the blade, eating the tender white part just below the ground, and in bad cases, so complete is the undercutting that the whole surface is left with a coating of loose withered herbage, readily skimmed off as hay. Indeed, It is the close, dense and often mossy bottoms of meadows and pastures on other lands with a thick soil covering of grass that gives the field vole advantage and protection, and food being abundant, also absent of rodent devouring animals and birds for multiplying. And as the females outnumber the males in the proportion of about 75%, and as each female brings forth 8 to 10 young every 6 or 8 weeks, the young begin to breed when 8 weeks old. The total progeny of one female may in the course of a breeding season from March to late in autumn amount to thousands, say 10,000. Mild winters and dry spring and summer weather favour their increase. Damp weather, heavy rainfall and frost without snow tend to limit their prolificness. From the breeding places, the field voles move to fresh fields and pastures new, invading dry hill pastures, heather-clad moorlands and young plantations, also nurseries, everywhere destroying much, if not all, edible growth, meaning in hill pastures and moorlands impoverishment of stock, and in young plantations and nurseries serious devastation. In plantations they bark young trees, biting through ash, beech, hazel, willow, larch and Scots pine of 2 to 5 years' growth, while saplings of broadleaf species are sometimes barked at around the height of 6 to 10 inches above the soil when several years of age. Though the field vole is ever present, it is only in certain periods that it assumes the nature of a plague. It gets darker and darker. And these date from 1581, when Holinshed recorded the appearance of mice in the marshes of Dungey Hundred in Essex to such an extent as to shear and gnaw the grass by the roots, spoiling and tainting the same with their venomous teeth, in such sort that the cattle there grazed, which grazed thereon were smitten with a murrain and died thereof. Which vermin, by policy of man, could not be destroyed, till at last there flocks together such a number of owls as all the shire was not able to yield, whereby the marshholders were shortly delivered from the vexation of the said mice. Similar visitations, according to Stowe, Childray, Lilly, Anstis, Lord Glenbervie, and Sir Walter Elliot, etc., occurred in various parts of England and Scotland in 1615, 1648, 1660, 1745, 1813, 1820. So we've got this like story of this animal which seems completely innocuous, which at various different points in history has like become a plague, and that's what I had the makings of at my site on a very small 2-acre scale. So this is dark ecology. This is like the contradictions and ironies that exist within nature when you allow yourself to have that close kind of interface, when you put yourself into the position of being beholden and dependent away from sort of constructed systems. So anyone who's grown a garden in Cornwall or tried to grow any salad, for example, knows that one of the biggest things we're up against here are slugs. In my garden I was trying all sorts of different methods to control them, from all the various different organic vegetable growing books, you know, like beer traps, and tried slug pellets, tried nematodes. In the end it just got so time consuming that I just used to go out at night with a head torch and a pair of scissors and just cut them in half where they were, because it was me or them, you know. How can I actually quantify this, and how many slugs maketh the man? That was the question. So, I made a series of devices, extending my use of the scissor for chopping the slug, to try and get an idea of how to quantify this relationship. So this is the first one. This is a gallery census counter, of which there is one in the Kessel Barton office, and every time you press the button it counts one on. So you use them in traffic censuses and in gallery countings. So I just connected that to the scissor so that every time you open the scissor it counts one on, and then you chop. First iteration, and in the first year I counted about 1,500 slugs that I killed in the garden. So if I hadn't have done that, yes, I wouldn't be here today talking to you. I would have wasted away. But then, it became interesting to me of like how we as humans living in the modern age with technology, how our relationship with nature on that direct interface where our lives interact with the lives of other species in a direct way, which we don't normally see, of course, because those interactions are usually hidden between different layers of technology, or we've given the job of growing our food away to somebody else and they're using machines, which, you know, when you're driving around in a tractor cab, you don't see when your plough is cutting a worm in the ground, but when you're digging with a spade in the allotment, you do. So it's all about proximity, and it's all about different layers of technology. So I started to think about that and started to come up with devices to put more and more layers of technology between myself and this actual action, the real interface between me and this other species, the slug. So this is the second iteration. Oh, sorry, that one. So that's called the slugometric. It's slugometric 1. This is slugometric 2. So you've still got the census counter here. You've got a motor and you've got some batteries. So you switch it on. And then when you close the scissor, it closes a micro switch there. So the motor actually cuts the slug in half, not you. So you've given away the responsibility of your action to like a machinic interface.
I'm going to switch off because it's too dangerous. I'm going to switch off. I'm going to switch off. I'm going to switch off. I'm going to switch off because it's too dangerous.
There are all sorts of ways of capturing animals and birds and fish. I spent most of my time up to the age of 15 or so trying out many of these ways. And when my enthusiasm began to wane, as it did gradually, I started to write poems, said Ted Hughes. The hawk in the rain. I drown in the drumming ploughland. I drag up heel after heel from the swallowing of the earth's mouth. From clay that clutches my each step to the ankle with the habit of the dogged grave. But the hawk, effortlessly at height, hangs his still eye. His wings hold all creation in a weightless quiet, steady as a hallucination in the streaming air, while banging wind kills these stubborn hedges, thumbs my eyes, throws my breath, tackles my heart, and rain hacks my head to the bone. The hawk hangs. The diamond point of will that pole stars the sea drowner's endurance and I, bloodily grabbed, dazed last moment counting, morsel in the earth's mouth, strained towards the master fulcrum of violence, where the hawk hangs still. That maybe in his own time meets the weather, coming the wrong way, suffers the air, hurled upside down, fall from his eye, the ponderous shires crash on him, the horizon trap him, the round angelic eye, smashed, mix his heart's blood with the mire of the land.
Right, and on that note, if you're ready for it,
I am. Yeah,
I'm going to pass over to John. So John Nixon is Dom's neighbour, lives in Helston, and can I call? Is it right? Can we call you like a professional hunter?
No,
no. It's just like quite a big part of your life.
It's quite important. My life. Not professional.
Okay.
Alright. So I give you the stage, yeah?
Thank you very much. Okay, so yeah, so mine's going to be a little low on philosophy compared to that, I'm afraid.
Don't be afraid,
that's exactly
what we want.
Mine's sort of the cartoons, you know. I'm going to talk a bit about lamping with dogs. I'll explain that a bit better in a minute. Sadly, I'm not one of these natural, highly amusing speakers who can turn everything into a wonderful entertainment, so I'm going to keep it pretty short. As pretty much everybody knows, dogs and humans have got along well for quite a long time, many thousands of years, but recently DNA sequencing has started to indicate that wolves and domestic dogs separated as species somewhat longer ago than we had originally thought, and they're saying now that domestic dogs branched off 30 to 40,000 years ago, which was still when the human being was in the hunter-gatherer phase, before we started agriculture. So humans and dogs have been cooperating in one way or another to the point where at the species branched off for that amount of time. It's a long time. As I just said, I'm certainly not a professional hunter. I don't even consider myself an expert on hunting rabbits with dogs. But should the apocalypse occur, and we started looking at that as a means to supplement our diet, then I've pretty much started off where people would start off in that situation. So I've been doing it fairly recently. My background is that I used to be a professional dog trainer. I've trained working dogs for many different purposes. And I also used to poach rabbits with an air rifle many years ago. So we had the dog training, we had the rabbit hunting, but now I put the two together. Rabbits as a resource. I'm told, I haven't counted them, but apparently there are around 38 million rabbits in the UK. It's difficult to get data. And some people say that the rabbit population is rising, and some people say that the rabbit population is falling. I have no way to know which way is the truth. I do know that in certain parts of the country the rabbit population is increasing, and that other places it's going down, but there's no way to know, as far as I can see, whether that means an overall increase or a decrease. Nutritional value. I don't hunt them as a sport. I enjoy hunting them, but it's not just a sport. They do have a nutritional value, which is good, since we are going to, in fact, be eating them later on. I whittle away at my rabbits. We're going to do a bit of skinning and butchering. But as my wife will tell you, having skinned it, I tend to sit there watching the television and taking all the little bits of meat off it. For no other reason. She'll say to me, you could just boil it. Just boil it. We're going to feed it to the dogs anyway. Just boil it up. But it's a very satisfying technical exercise to get all the meat off them. So I know how much meat's on one. And on a decent-sized rabbit, you get about 750 grams of quality meat. So that is not an insignificant amount of meat.
Fog lifts from the harbour. Dawn goes down today. An agent crests the shadows of a nearby alleyway. Piles of broken bricks, signposts on the path. Every moment points toward the aftermath. Yeah. Straggle back from their nights out on the town. Hopeless urchins from the city gather round. Spies from Imperial China wash in with the tide. Every battle heads to war. Surrender on both sides. And I am coming home to you with my.
Lead to war, the same blocked intersection. I am coming.
yeah, so this, what I'm going to do is just is show you what I would normally do as soon as we caught it. So generally speaking, if you get hold of them, yes, into your rabbit. If you kind of stroke them down there when they're fresh, any urine that in them will come out.
Oh, you do it from the back, so this is the big thing. I read about this and I thought, I've tried to watch YouTube videos and never seen it, but that's why I came right, to see it practically done. So it's down the back, you rub
just
it down
the back, yeah.
And it
and just release, yeah. And then you just need to get hold of it. You can feel, it's intestines, but you can feel just the skin.
Oh, yeah.
So you need to just get the skin there.
Yeah, got it, yeah.
And if you get it just down there, put a little nick in like that, and then you can just. With some rabbits, not the ones down here, I hasten to add, some rabbits you can actually skin them without a knife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're soft enough you can just tear them. But the ones down here are phenomenally tough for some reason, as this one is demonstrating.
Mm.
You just need to get into there. And what you can do is you just, just get two fingers in. And then you must slit. And what you want to try and avoid is puncturing the bowel because it's smelly. It's not so smelly as like it's overpowering. And this one, in fact, you can see what we have here is already punctured because Impy has thoughtfully stuck her teeth into it. So that's.
So has it leaked?
That is going to. Yeah, so that will leak.
Yeah.
So. When they used to hang, draw and quarter people, they just used to put a stick in and wind it out. So you don't need very much, but the bigger the gap, the easier it is to deal with, basically. I mean, that's as bad as the smell ever gets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, I personally don't see what the deal is, but some people obviously don't, like an Ingsy here, where she's just torn. So that's its intestines. So we can just pull them out.
And the liver?
I'll get that just a sec, I'll show you that. So there's a kidney. There's all kinds of bits I have no idea what they are.
So where was the bladder itself infected?
That's probably still in.
Still in there, okay. Yeah.
What we've got there is the diaphragm.
I see that.
And if we get through there, just poke a hole in it, and we can get. Go, heart and lungs. That. The transplant surgeons wish they could do it that neatly. Not. There we go. But that's it. That's paunching them.
Yeah.
So that's everything that's out there that we need to. What we would normally do, I mean, they're not normally, you can see the mess she's made of it.
Yeah.
But, so they're now ready to skin.
Mm-hmm.
So we can skin them from now, and then we're into the butchery stage.
Okay.
When you're doing bigger animals, what you normally do is you would cut round the anus and you would cut into the neck and you basically would pull the intestine out and knot it and then, same here, you'd get the esophagus and you would cut that and knot it because then you can take all of the internal organs out with any droppings or stomach acids or anything like that,
it's all in one
contaminating the meat.
Exactly.
But you can usually get the skin off and just get your fingers round the back and then just pull the skin away.
Yeah.
You know, and if you've chopped the feet off, you can just like rip the skin off. The rabbits down here are very tough for some bizarre reason. And just take the skirt off normally. Probably do that first, to be honest. And then you get these nice fillets, which is what I'm after.
Yeah.
This one's a bit bitty. Like
that.
So they're the nicest bits, to be honest.
And those can be pan fried or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah, pan fried and then just sliced up and served with a salad or whatever. And they're great. And the rest of it, I would boil up. I wouldn't even bother with the rest of it.
Mm.
Unless I'm bored and I sit there and I'll take all the muscles off them and then take everything off there. Mm. You know, and there's a bit there, sort of trapezius muscles, I suppose.
you know, which you can kind of get off. If you can bother to go down it with a little filleting knife and go along the ribs, and you know, there's bits there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But normally I would just chuck that in the pan and make a stock or whatever.
Yeah.
But because it's the loin and yeah. the back legs that you're after, really.
Yeah. Okay.
The rest of it is a bonus.
Yeah. But the French make rabbit with mustard, don't they?
It's just... I mean... Delicious. I find... Yeah, you can do that. I personally...
It requires slow cooking, though, that.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it does. But I find that, that with most of it, I find it hasn't got sufficient flavour. So a lot of times, because it's a good, nice, lean, good quality meat, then I'll use that and something with a stronger flavour in a dish, so that something else adds the flavour, and that just gives you a really good source of good quality lean meat to bulk it out with. So if you were doing steak and kidney pie or something like that, or sometimes I do like a cottage pie type thing. So you've got a bit of beef in there or something like that with a bit of flavour, and then you can use that to pad it out and get the nutrition.
So shall we do the shall we get the other carcasses in and do everyone wants to have a go?
Yes, if anyone wants to have a go.
We've got some water, we've got anti-vax soap, so get in there and don't worry about it.
Let's move to the country. Let's move to the country. Just you and me. My travels are over. Travels are through. Let's move to the country, just me and you.
Right, second quote of the day. And these little quotes are really about thinking about how our perception of nature has changed over through history. So this is a very, very interesting little book, The Criminal Prosecution and Capital Punishment of Animals, which is it's a history book which shows how throughout history all sorts of animals have been put on trial by humans for various different crimes, from bees that didn't make enough honey, to pigs that allegedly trampled a child to death, dogs that bite their owners, impi, and stuff like that. And it's very fascinating to me because it shows how, how people have struggled with this idea of responsibility and struggled with the idea that
It's kind of more about, it sort of charts the development of the separation of human consciousness from a wider consciousness, like when, as you know, if you can put a pig on trial for a misdemeanor, then are you like giving that pig like human attributes, or do you still think that humans are somehow animals or something? It's like, it's sort of a very blurry line. But anyway, on the subject of slugs, sometimes the obnoxious vermin were generously forewarned. Thus, the grand vicars of Jean Rohan, Cardinal Bishop of Autun, having been informed that slugs were devastating several estates in different parts of his diocese on the 17th of August 1487, ordered public processions to be made for 3 days in every parish, and enjoined upon the said slugs to quit the territory within this period under penalty of being accursed. On the 8th of September 1488, a similar order was issued at Bugeaud. The curates were charged to make processions during the offices, and the slugs were warned 3 times to cease from vexing the people by corroding and consuming the herbs of the fields and the vines, and to depart. Quote, "And if they do not heed this our command, we excommunicate them and smite them with our anathema."
In conclusion,
we cannot get away from our naturalness. We never will.
It is to argue that the very idea of nature, which so many hold dear, will have to wither away in an ecological state of human society. Ecology must stop being associated with the image of a small, nature-loving minority or with qualified specialists. It involves us all, for all things are delicately interconnected. You've been listening to Critical Camp, a Trail Mix special produced by Bram Thomas Arnold, commissioned by Castlebar Rural Centre for Contemporary Art on the Lisbon Cornwall.